As America begins the celebration of its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum thought it would be appropriate to create our own recognition of this important milestone. Welcome to Vashon 250, a look back at what was happening in America 250 years ago and comparing it to what has happened over the past 250 years of American history, what is happening in our current political life, and how these ideals and events have been reflected in the history of our own Vashon Island. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Hallman.
Thanks, John. Our approach to Vashon 250 during this 250th year of the United States of America as an independent nation uses the Declaration of Independence as an aspirational mission statement, the Constitution as a working user's manual, and the events of the American Revolution as a guide to help us understand who we are as a nation, how we came to be who we are, and how Vashon Island fits into this larger narrative structure.
Welcome to episode number 7 of Vashon 250. Today we put on our tricorner hats and we look at the Townsend Acts. They were created in June 1767, and they were a series of British Acts of the Parliament enacted in 1766 and 1767. Introducing a series of taxes and regulations to enable administration of the British colonies in America. They are named after Charles Townsend, the Chancellor of the Exchequer who proposed the program, and there were 5 Townsend Acts. And before we go forward, I want to refer you to the calendar on our website, Vashon, voiceofvashon.org, and specifically under our show, Vashon 250. And if you have that calendar handy, you can follow along a little better with some of the dates, which just listening to them can become a little onerous. But with the calendar, I think you'll find it quite helpful. So with that in mind, the Revenue Act of 1767, passed on 29 June 1767, placed taxes on glass, lead, painter's colors, otherwise house paint, paper, and tea. It also gave the Supreme Court of each colony the power to issue writs of assistance, general warrants that could be issued to customs officers, and used to search private property for smuggled goods.
And, you know, the Revenue Act is one of the key sort of points of tension between the British Crown and the colonies, because it was all about extracting revenue. And, British common law essentially had established the right of British citizens to determine their own taxes, or at least to have a voice in the determining their own taxes. And of course, the British government did not see the colonists as citizens. And so it set up this immediate tension between the colonies and the crown. And also, you look at that list, glass, lead, painter's colors, paper, tea. I mean, these are things people used every day in their lives. And so it had a huge impact on colonists and on everyday life in the colonies. The other part of it is that sense of, you know, an Englishman's castle. Home is his castle, if you will. And the idea of a writ of assistance, that a general warrant that gave the customs officers the ability to search private property for smuggled goods without the sort of consent of the property owner, again, touches on that very basic sense of what was the right of a colonist as a citizen of the British Empire.
Also, on the 29th of June of 1767, it was clearly a very busy day, the Commissioners of Customs Act of 1767 was passed, and this created a new customs board for the North American colonies to be headquartered in Boston with 5 customs commissioners. The board was created to enforce shipping regulations and increase tax revenue. Previously, customs enforcement was handled by the customs board back in England. Once the new customs board was in operation, enforcement increased, leading to a confrontation with smuggling colonists. And incidents between customs officials, military personnel, and colonists broke out across the colonies, eventually leading to the occupation of Boston by British troops and the Boston Massacre in 1770.
Again, it's and we see that a bit in our situation right now in January of 2026, where enforcement of immigration policies along the border become very different when you send immigration officials and border control officials into American cities. And that's when, in essence, what you saw happening with this Commissioners of Customs Act. What it did is it took that sort of remote management of customs, taxation, and collection away from London and put it right in Boston in the heart of the colonies. And so it was like sending ICE agents and border control agents into Minneapolis, Minnesota, which we're seeing right now here in the middle of January 2026. It creates a tension that had not existed before.
So then, just a few days later, on the 2nd of July, 1767, the Indemnity Act of 1767 was passed, and it was intended to reduce taxes on the East India Company when they imported tea into Britain. This allowed them to re-export the tea to the colonies more cheaply and resell it to the American colonies. Until this time, all items had to be shipped to Britain first from wherever they were made and then re-exported to their destination, including to the colonies. The EIC was one of Britain's largest companies, but on the verge of collapse due to American colonists smuggling cheaper tea purchased from the Dutch sellers. Part of the purpose of the entire series of Townsend Acts was to save the company from imploding.
Yeah, the British East India Company was an interesting sort of mercantile corporation, under the British government, in which individual business people profited, but also the British government prospered. When you talk about indemnity, what does it mean? Indemnity means to hold harmless. And so what this Indemnity Act did was essentially hold the East India Company harmless from any effect of imposing these new taxes on tea on the colonies and being collected directly by the importers, the East India Company, and by the British tax collectors and revenue agents. So what you see is a real sort of conflict growing between the interest of Britain in revenue, the interest of maintaining this sort of public corporation, almost government corporation, the East India Company, and extracting that at the expense of the American colonists.
And if we think back, this is a time when Britain was still the world power.
Very much so.
And we were pushing up against that power with all of our activities.
Which brings us to today, 2026, and Trump tariffs, which we'll come back and talk about a bit more later.
Okay, we'll stay tuned for that. So then, again, on the 2nd of July, 1767, the New York Restraining Act of 1767 was passed that forbade the New York Assembly and the Governor of New York from passing any new bills until they complied with the Quartering Act of 1765. We talked about that a few episodes ago. That activity required New York authorities to provide housing, foodstuffs, and supplies for the British troops stationed there to defend the colony. The New York Assembly resisted the Quartering Act on the grounds it did not limit the number of troops to be quartered and that Parliament could not constitutionally tax the colony without its consent. And again, we talked about this in our last episode.
Yeah, and what's interesting here to think about is what, in effect, the British Parliament is saying to the state of New York or the colony of New York is that you can't do anything until you comply with this Quartering Act. And it essentially put a hold on New York running its own colonial affairs until they sort of lined up behind the purpose of the Quartering Act, which was to pay for the stationing of British troops in the colonies. And so what you get is this attempt to sort of take away the basic right of colonists that they saw as the right of as English citizens to have a say in their own governance through their own colonial government and through their own colonial legislatures. And the English Parliament is saying, you can't do anything until you comply with this act that we've passed to allow us to quarter troops in your homes. I mean, you know, it's like lighting a match.
Yeah, very much so. So then we move ahead a year to the Vice Admiralty Court Act of 1768. It's passed on 8 March 1768, nearly a year after the other four. The act was passed to add the aid the prosecution of smugglers. It gave admiralty courts, rather than colonial courts, jurisdiction over all matters concerning customs violations and smuggling. The court decisions were made solely by the judge, without the option of a trial by jury, which was considered to be a fundamental right of British subjects. In addition, the accused person had to travel to the court of jurisdiction at his own expense. If he did not appear, he was automatically considered guilty.
Yeah, this is an interesting act by Parliament because it really flies in the face of fundamental rights of British citizens. One is the right to trial by jury of your peers. And of course, these admiralty courts were like military court-martials in effect. There were no juries, there were no peers. There was a single administrative judge making the decision. And that outraged a colonist. And then if you didn't show up, you were automatically assumed to be guilty and considered guilty and convicted of whatever crime you were accused of without any kind of trial. And so you can see how this, in the face of colonists' traditional views of themselves as British citizens with the rights of British citizens, we're all of a sudden seeing Parliament pulling away these very fundamental legal rights of citizens. And you see that again, another part of the flames that are building that lead to a revolution. The American colonists felt that they were being abused by the Parliament, that their fundamental rights as British citizens were being ignored or being overridden. And there's no... So it's not a surprise that the colonists begin to react in more and more violent ways to these sort of what they see as sort of depredations by the English Parliament.
So as part of this, Bruce, what was the definition of a smuggler? I mean, you think of a pirate or what have you, but I'm going to guess it wasn't nearly as dramatic as that.
Not nearly as romantic as a pirate. I mean, smugglers were basically... very similar to what we would consider moonshiners. They were basically bringing in products, particularly at this time, tea, from traders in the West Indies and in Europe and Holland in particular, who were selling, because Holland had, the Netherlands had huge tea plantations in Indonesia, which was basically Netherlands colony. And so the tea from Holland did not have all the taxes on it that the tea from England, because they weren't trying to support the British East India Company. And so you have this sort of economic sort of reason to bring in Netherlands tea or tea from Holland rather than tea from the British East India Company. And to do that, you had to bring it in secretly, or else you'd have to pay the tariffs on it. And so essentially, it became very much like moonshiners, you know, sort of producing their own alcoholic beverages and not paying the state sort of alcohol, state and federal alcohol taxes today. And so on one level, it was very innocent, you know, just bringing in tea to sell to your neighbors, but not paying the tariffs. And so that's smuggling at that time was very profitable because of the tax relatively high. And it was relatively easy because there weren't a lot of tax enforcement. There was not a lot of English Navy patrolling the coast to prevent this. And of course, what the British government was doing, they were trying to close those loopholes, and they began to impose these taxes. They began to bring in more tax collectors. They began to bring in the British Navy to patrol the coast. And what it did is it put more and more pressure on the colonists. And the colonists resisted, as you can imagine.
So if we skip now ahead to more modern times, we have the Reagan Revolution. And Ronald Reagan's 1980 landslide election resulted from a conservative shift to the right in American politics, including a loss of confidence in liberal New Deal and Great Society programs and priorities that had dominated the national agenda since the 1930s. Domestically, the Reagan administration enacted a major tax cut, sought to cut non-military spending, and eliminated federal regulations. The administration's economic policies, known as Reaganomics, were inspired by supply-side economics. We've heard the terms many, many times in subsequent years. The combination of tax cuts and an increase in defense spending led to budget deficits, and the federal deficit, or the federal debt, increased significantly during Reagan's tenure. Reagan signed the Tax Reform Act of 1986, simplifying the tax code by reducing rates and removing several tax breaks, and the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, which enacted sweeping changes to the U.S. immigration law and granted amnesty to 3 million illegal immigrants. Reagan also appointed more judges than any other president, including 4 Supreme Court justices. His foreign policy stance was resolutely anti-communist. Its plan of action, known as the Reagan Doctrine, sought to roll back the global influence of the Soviet Union in an attempt to end the Cold War. Under his doctrine, the Reagan administration initiated a massive buildup of the United States military, promoted new technologies, such as missile defense systems, and in 1983, undertook an invasion of Grenada.
Yeah, and, you know, the Reagan Revolution, it's interesting to think about in terms of where we are today with the sort of Trump MAGA revolution that we're in the midst of right now. You have to go back to the New Deal and to the progressive era at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries to find the establishment of what becomes known as sort of the traditional welfare state, is a term often used, although that's a misnomer, really. But the creation of a government that had responsibility for its citizens. And so many of the reforms of the progressive era, which brought about sort of government regulations, Federal Trade Commission, things to sort of regulate drugs and food and things like that, added to the New Deal reforms, which created a social sort of net, if you will, with Social Security, with the beginnings of what would become Medicare. And the whole idea that the government had a responsibility for its citizens by the time of the 1980s and 90s with Reagan Revolution, Reagan saw those, and many conservatives and many Republicans saw those, as having gone too far. And so the Reagan Revolution really becomes an attempt to roll back what had sort of occurred over the last 40, 50 years with the American political system. And it's really the beginning of the sort of what I would call conservative politics, of looking at minimum taxes, you know, minimum regulation, that goes on to steroids, if you will, with the Trump Revolution of the late 2010s and early 2020s, which we're in the midst of today.
And so then we have the Tea Party movement. And that was an American fiscally conservative political movement within the Republican Party that began in 2007. Hard to believe it's that long ago. And it catapulted it into the mainstream by Congressman Ron Paul's presidential campaign. The movement expanded in response to the policies of Democratic President Barack Obama and was a major factor in the 2010 wave election, in which Republicans gained 63 House seats and took control of the House of Representatives. Participants in the movement called for lower taxes and for a reduction of the national debt and federal budget deficit through decreased government spending. The movement supported small government principles and opposed the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. While the Tea Party was not a political party in the strict sense, research published in 2016 suggests that members of the Tea Party caucus voted like a right-wing third party in Congress. a major force behind the movement was Americans for Prosperity, AFP, a conservative political advocacy group founded by businessman and political activist David Koch.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about the Tea Party as sort of the second wave of the Reagan Revolution. It comes about, even though it begins in 2007, I mean, it really gains force after the major economic collapse of 2008 and sort of the housing crisis and the sort of bailout of the banks. And I mean, there's a whole set of things going on in 2008, 9, and 10, which give fuel to the Tea Party and to the Tea Party movement as a populist sort of movement to change the direction of the American government. And it really picks up all of those elements that you see in the Reagan Revolution from 30 years earlier and adds to them. And if you look into the future at 2007, 2008, as this Tea Party movement is coming together, it really begins to articulate and formulate the policies and the politics that would become the basis of the Trump Revolution of 2016 and 2024. And so what you get is this sort of continuing move beginning in the 1980s toward a rejection of the New Deal, to a rejection of the sort of American political system that had dominated through much of the 20th century, and the emergence of a counter-revolution, if you will, that sort of begins to see ways to limit the federal government, begin to limit individual responsibilities, begin to limit taxes, and begin to limit regulations. And so it's a really interesting sort of sequence to look at the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s, the Tea Party Revolution of the late 2000s, early 2010s, and where we are today in 2026 in the midst of a Trump revolution.
And to that regard, the Trump tariffs are an echo of the Townsend Acts, really, would you say?
Very much so. If you go back and think about the Townsend Acts as supporting a mercantile policy of Great Britain and supporting the British sort of East India Company and its tea monopoly, what you begin to see with President Trump's concern with tariffs is his attempt to sort of reestablish an American mercantile policy that gives advantage to American manufacturers, gives advantage to American businesses and American exports over imports from around the world. It's sort of a reaction to what Bill Clinton introduces in the 1990s. As trying to blend sort of the Reagan Revolution with the social and welfare concerns of the New Deal Revolution. And what you get is a sort of intense reaction to that that comes out in the Trump tariffs and in the whole idea of America First. The New Deal, the post-World War II world with the United Nations, the sense of the growing of globalization, particularly in the 1990s, with the technological revolution going on with the internet, is all of a sudden running into a wall with the resistance by many Americans who see it having gone too far. And Trump's solution is tariffs. Now, tariffs, in my estimation, are a terrible way to run an economy, and we're seeing that in but right now, that's the direction our government is taking in sort of trying to reestablish an American mercantile system over a globalized system.
And really the question with that is, can we rebuild that system as we once had? And we may be way too far down the road for that, but to bring all that manufacturing back into the States and do everything he's dreamed of and tax the rest of the world to make it happen. It makes no sense.
Well, it's if you talk to economists, I mean, most economists are horrified because they understand that basically globalization has many economic benefits. It certainly has economic consequences, and what the American government did not do well was deal with the impact of those consequences, which it could have done. There are lots of ways that you can mitigate the impact of the loss of industrial jobs with the creation of other kinds of jobs, and particularly with the emergence of a new technological industry, if you will, with high tech and computers and the internet and now AI. There's many ways to sort of deal with dislocations that comes from moving steel plants overseas. Number one, the steel produced overseas is much more, is done much more efficiently than it is here. And yet at the same time, you lose a whole steel industry. And that's the sort of dilemma that we're confronting right now, is we've got two extremes fighting each other, and we're not finding the middle way that will allow both globalization to work at its best and the protection of domestic welfare on the, and domestic workers at their best.
Are we getting... So Bruce, with all of that, let's jump into Vashon. How has the island been like the American colonies, and what actions have been like the Townsend Acts?
Well, I think the very nature of Vashon Island and the fact that we do not have a government of our own puts us exactly in the situation that the American colonies were in. We are dependent on King County and the state of Washington, and to some extent the federal government, to do all the regulating and all the sort of policing and sort of taxing and all that stuff that affects the island. I mean, we do have a few small government agencies on the island, you know, the fire district, the park district, the airport district, you know, things like that. We have water districts, all that have taxing authority to some extent. But in a sense, for the major taxes, sales tax, property tax, we're all dependent on the state of Washington or King County, and of course for income tax on the federal government. And maybe the state of Washington,
if,
the
if they get their way,
if the current administration in Olympia gets their way and begins to impose a state income tax. But when you look at Vashon in terms of determining its own destiny, in terms of its economy, we've always been a vassal state. We've always been under the control of other government bodies, particularly King County and the state of Washington, just like the colonies were under the control of Parliament. They had their own sort of legislatures. They had their own colonial sort of legislatures. But they did not have a lot of power, and that power could be overridden by the power of the federal government and by the power of Parliament. You know, with Vashon, I mean, we have some control over our destiny, but we're dependent on things like the community council, like our local taxing districts, and our appeals to King County legislators, our council members, and appeal to our legislators in Olympia for everything that affects the island. We don't have our own police force. We don't have our own garbage collection. We don't have our own streets. We don't have, our own electric sort of grid. You know, all those things go down the list. We're dependent on the outside world.
And that concludes our Episode 7. Next time, join us when we talk about the Boston Massacre. Bruce and I invite you to join us each week for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island heritage. And our programs are available on the Voice of Vashon website at voiceofvashon.org. Go to the site and click on your choice of saved programs. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic, please drop us a note to Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. That's Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a presentation of Voice of Vashon, your island connection. The show is produced by Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services. NACM serves business, credit, and finance departments across the Fruited Plain. We appreciate their support. And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.